Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Michael Castleman's newest book, Sizzling Sex for Life, published in January, is extraordinary. It's an encyclopedia of sex. Everything you want to know in one book, and I would say a whole lot that you won't find anywhere else. Welcome back to this program, Michael Castleman.
Oh, thanks for having me, Diana. I love being on your show, and I love your book, too.
Well, thank you. And you reviewed it in your on your blog in Psychology Today, which was very generous of you. But we're going to talk in depth about your book, but especially Chapter 51, Men, Porn, and the Controversy Surrounding Sex Addiction. And we're going to focus on this chapter because of the spa killings in Atlanta last week. And, of course, investigators are still trying to unravel the motivation. But, Michael, you and I both believe it was not necessarily anti-Asian racism. Rather, it's likely his sex-negative, evangelical, fundamentalist upbringing. And, in fact, the shooter himself blamed it on his sexual addiction. So let's get into it.
Let's.
Yes. Do you want to start with sort of what your beliefs are about sexual addiction? Because you describe them very well.
Sure.
In your book, yeah.
Well, Americans use the term addiction very loosely. And, you know, if you like chocolate, you're a chocoholic. If you like coffee, you're a Java junkie. People say they're addicted to, you know, the internet, bacon, shopping, whatever. Sex addiction, that term is also used way too loosely. The research on sex addiction shows that people, overwhelmingly men, are sex addicts, not women. But the research shows that men who call themselves sex addicts don't have more sex or more unusual sex or view more porn than other men. They're pretty average in their actual consumption of sexual media and their actual sexual activity. The main difference between so-called sex addicts and the rest of men is that they have a very high likelihood of having been raised in deeply sex-negative families and religious institutions that make them feel tremendous guilt and shame about sex. And then what happens is that generates a lot of stress. And other research is very clear that one of the ways men deal with stress is from self-sexing, because orgasm is relaxing. And so men who feel stressed masturbate, often to porn. They have orgasms, and then they relax a little bit. But what this does for men who are deeply distressed about their sexuality and their sexual upbringing is that they feel stress because of their sex-negative backgrounds. They stroke to porn, and that just makes them feel more distressed. Instead of feeling relaxed, which they feel momentarily, but as soon as they get over that, they feel even more distressed. And so it's a vicious cycle of feeling sexual distress, trying to relieve it with masturbating to porn, and then feeling more distress, which sends them back to porn again. So really, sex is not the problem in sex addiction. What's the problem is the guilt and shame that these men have been raised to feel, including, from all accounts, the guy in Atlanta who was a member of a very conservative evangelical Southern Baptist church, and he also had previously complained about sex addiction. He had tried to stop viewing pornography. He was the classic quote-unquote sex addict in that he was deeply stressed around his sexuality. But sex addiction as an affliction, it's fiction. It doesn't really exist. In fact, the leading sexuality organizations in the United States dismiss it as ridiculous. And the DSM-5, the Bible of Mental Health Conditions, has deleted all references to it, as psychologists have come to understand that it's not sex that's addicting here. It is guilt and shame that people feel from their sex-negative upbringings.
And you break it down so well in your book, Sizzling Sex for Life, because you talk certainly about the negative sexual upbringing and the fundamentalists and evangelical, but you ask, are sex and porn addictive? You ask this in your chapter 51, and you point out so correctly that many porn viewers sample a number of enormous range of hardcore possibilities, and that's not tolerance, which is in true addiction. There is a tolerance for alcohol or maybe gambling, but it's you say it usually reflects either curiosity or boredom, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, the neurobiology of this is we're talking about dopamine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter of pleasure, and so when you hug a child or pet a kitten or lick an ice cream cone, there's some dopamine released in your brain because you're feeling good. And one of the things that releases dopamine is novelty. And that's why lovemaking feels hotter in hotel rooms than it does at home, because the hotel room is something new and different, so you get more dopamine.
For sure.
So when advocates of the sex addiction model say that men flip from various, that they develop a tolerance for regular old porn and they go to extreme porn, and they call that tolerance, that's a complete misunderstanding of the biology of addiction. And basically, they just want to release more dopamine, and the way you do that is to see new things. And so men flip among all kinds of different porn possibilities, the way people channel surf on television. If you watch one show and then all of a sudden you channel surf, are you suddenly addicted? No, you're just sampling.
Of course not.
And you're just seeing new things. The sex addiction model completely violates all that's known medically about addiction. I mean, there's no tolerance, there's no withdrawal syndrome. I mean, it's just the guy who coined the term sex addiction, Patrick Carnes, in 1983, he basically made it all up. He was a counselor who was dealing with actual addicts. They were drug addicts and alcoholics. And he thought, oh, gee, sex kind of looks like this. Let's invent sex addiction. And we've been dealing with the consequences now for almost 40 years. And unfortunately, the term sex addiction has become embedded in our vocabulary, so that when you say to people, oh, he's a sex addict, people kind of know what that is. But in fact, it's totally wrong. And I should hasten to add that in the United States, quote-unquote sex addicts are overwhelmingly conservative evangelical Christians. But it's not the religion that is the problem. It is the fundamentalism of the religion. If you look at what happens in other countries with other religions, in Israel, the same thing happens with the ultra-Orthodox, who are extremely sex-negative as any Southern Baptist preacher. And they develop the same kinds of obsessions with sex because it's the forbidden fruit. They're told, don't do this, and of course, people want to do it. It's like you'd say to someone, don't think about an elephant. Well, what are they going to think about? It's like they're thinking about the elephant.
So essentially, a lot of the fundamentalist religions preach that essentially that God hates sex unless it's for procreation.
Right. Procreation or maybe cementing holy wedlock, but recreational sex, which includes self-sexing and casual sex, sex before marriage, dealing with, you know, group sex, sex workers, all that kind of stuff, but primarily men self-sexing to porn is the sort of fundamental symptom of what people call sex addiction. And it's so sad because when you call someone an addict, it just makes them more upset, more tense, more stressed, and sends them to stroking to more porn to get more relief. The way to deal with compulsive sexual behavior is with a therapy known as cognitive behavioral therapy, and it has shown very good success in a number of studies, and it is based on correcting incorrect thinking. So guys who think they're sex addicts say, oh my God, if I masturbate to porn, I'm going to go to hell.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
A cognitive behavioral therapist would say, well, no, actually, why do you believe that? You've just been told that. There's no real proof that that's happening. Plenty of people masturbate as much as you do and feel fine about it. So really, sex addiction is it's so tragic because it's created by fundamentalism, and it is relieved by correcting people's incorrect fundamentalist beliefs. And there are plenty of devout conservative Christians who are now trying to do that very thing, to get the sex negativity out of Christianity. And I, you know, personally, I wish them the best of luck.
Exactly. Me too. I have, over the years, I've had a number of clients, seeing couples who are come out of evangelical churches, and they wait until they're married, until they have first intercourse. And often what turns up is the man has sometimes erectile dysfunction because now he can finally do it, but according to the church, but he has still so much anxiety about it. And more revealing, perhaps, is that the woman turns up with vaginismus, which is, for the listeners, that's where their contractions around the vaginal opening are often so strong that penetration isn't even possible. And then I was just recently talking to a female client who had been raised in the Lutheran kind of evangelical church. And when she was 17, her parents discovered birth control in her purse. And they threw it out, and they made her promise never to use it. And so then she went to Planned Parenthood and got herself an IUD. So she was on a mission to correct her religious upbringing. She had sexual feelings, and she had a boyfriend, and she wanted to be sexual. But let's go back to the cognitive behavioral therapy, which is mainly what I use. And you write about sexual catastrophizing, and I like the three that you summarize here. These mistaken ideas: sexual thoughts and fantasies are wrong, harmful, sinful. Only bad people masturbate, and porn is evil. Break those down for us, please.
Well, you know, the idea that sexual thoughts are a sin is just, it's tragic. I mean, people have all kinds of thoughts all the time. You're not responsible for your dreams. You're not responsible for your daydreams. You're not responsible for your thoughts. You're simply responsible for your actions. And the sex negative people criminalize thought. There are no thought crimes. This isn't 1984. There's no thought crimes. You can think whatever you want. Control your actions. And don't demonize yourself for your thoughts. I mean, you might as well beat yourself up for what you dream at night, over which you have no control. You know, lovemaking is a lot like meditation. In both lovemaking and meditation, you take a break from your daily routine, you get into something different emotionally and in your mind. And people who meditate know that all kinds of crazy thoughts go through your head. And meditation teachers say, observe them, accept them, and then gently brush them aside. That's all you have to do to get past them. If you fixate and you go nuts because you're thinking about being sexual with, you know, the girl who sat behind you in third grade, that just hurts you. And it doesn't do anything, and it has no impact on your life other than hurting you. And so cognitive behavioral therapists say, look, accept your thoughts, control your actions. Think about sex all you want, but don't be sexual in irresponsible ways. So that's one thing. Then only bad people masturbate. This is a cornerstone of the sex negative worldview. And what's uninformed about it is that everybody masturbates. Everybody. Recently, a couple of years ago, researchers in Canada wanted to compare the sexual attitudes of men who watched porn and masturbated to it and who didn't. And they couldn't find anybody who hadn't seen porn, hadn't masturbated to porn. Masturbation is universal, and that people have different frequencies of how much they like to do it, but it's fine to get involved in self-loving. I mean, that's how we learn about erotic touch. It's how you learn to have orgasms. Orgasms have to be learned, and the teacher is solo sex.
That's right.
So here again.
Yes.
Masturbation is something, you know, I think parents always have to confront the fact that their kids masturbate. And and some people tell their kids, don't do that. It's evil. It's nasty. It's a sin. You're going to go to hell, which, of course, just makes the kids all upset and do it more. Enlightened parents say, what you're doing is perfectly normal, perfectly natural. The important thing to remember is that it's private. It's like going to the bathroom. Just like you don't go to the bathroom in public, you don't masturbate in public. Do it behind closed doors. Do it in your bedroom with the door closed, and it's fine. Accept it. It's okay. Everybody does it. But it's a private activity, and keep it private.
Exactly what I said to my children when they were little, and I'm sure you did when your children were little, too.
Oh, yeah.
It is the enlightened approach, and it also gives your children permission to explore their bodies and enjoy pleasure.
Right.
And that's so important. I co-led with Dr. Maria Flaherty two women's groups for 8 years. This is when I was in Palo Alto, and all of these women had some kind of sexual trauma, and very few of them were able to reach orgasm because they had trouble letting go, and all the images of being sexually abused and it would come to their minds. And so the first suggestion was for the group was to masturbate at home and to learn about their bodies. And it often worked, and they started having orgasms. And then when I was at UCLA at the Female Sexual Medicine Center, what we discovered, and this is before I moved to Seattle 12 years ago, what we discovered there is that probably if a woman had not masturbated as a teenager, and almost always she came out of a religious upbringing, including, by the way, Catholicism. I had one Catholic patient who the only way she could reach orgasm was to lie on her stomach on the carpet and rock. And this is, you know, from the time she was I don't know, 6 or 7 years old on through teenager. Well, she was, look, Ma, I'm not touching myself.
Right.
But it's not partner compatible. And so what the urologist that I worked with at UCLA, what she came up with was that probably the neural pathways that go from the brain to the genitals have not been laid down if there's no masturbation as a teenager. And so then they almost always require a vibrator, which goes 300 RPMs much faster, and they need that extra stimulation in order to maybe lay down some of those neural pathways and experience orgasm. And once, I have had so many clients over the 30-plus years I've been doing this work have their first orgasms, and then, of course, they're so much more likely to want to have sex more because the payoff is so high and it's so delicious. But all of these beliefs, I've been talking about women, you focus on men, as is correct, especially with porn viewing. Of course, women are with their partners. I don't think you mentioned this in this chapter, but I've seen it elsewhere that women who watch porn and maybe even female-centric porn, where females are pleasured, like Candida Royale's movies, that if they watch with their partner and it's not a secret, it actually can be illuminating and educational. And I get couples to stop this. I used to loan out when I was in Palo Alto years ago. I'd loan out Candida Royale's movies because they were so explicit and yet it focused on the couple and their pleasure. And so women can enjoy porn too in the right circumstances and if it's not secret.
Yeah, one of the tenets of sex negative institutions is that men are wicked because they masturbate, and women are more holy because they don't. Well, that's ridiculous. Plenty of women masturbate. In fact, more than half of American adult women own a vibrator, and very few use them in partner lovemaking. And ergo, they're using their vibrators solo, and this is using vibrators to for sexual pleasure and orgasm is very common among American women. And so the men who think, oh, I'm evil because I do this and my wife doesn't, or the very common case is that the wife or girlfriend discovers, you know, porn on the guy's phone or computer and says, you're a sex addict and I don't do that. Well, all this is really about sex negative upbringing and guilt and shame from it. And if people could just take a deep breath and understand that sex is really about pleasure, not pain, not distress, the world would be better off and there would be 8 people alive in Atlanta who are now dead.
So true. I want to quote a Dr. Onishi. He's associate professor of religious studies at Skidmore College, and he grew up in a strict evangelical community in Southern California that emphasized sexual purity. There's a story about how he spent his teenage years tearing out advertisements in surfing magazines that featured women in bikinis. But he also traded his online password with friends to hold himself accountable. He said, we had a militant vigilance. Don't let anything in the house that would tempt you sexually. And he said the evangelical culture he was raised in teaches women to hate their bodies as a source of temptation, and it teaches men to hate their minds, which lead them into lust and sexual immorality. This is really messed up.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it, you know, his whole experience is very common, where the message to young people from sex-negative institutions is don't think about it. Don't think about sex. Don't think about it. Well, if you tell people don't think about it, they think about it more. I mean, there was a study in Israel where they surveyed secular Israelis and ultra-Orthodox Israelis, and they asked them, how often do you think about sex? And the ultra-Orthodox people thought about it like 10 times more because it was the forbidden fruit. It was something that they had been harangued not to think about. So, of course, that's all they could think about. When people admit sexuality and sexual pleasure into their lives as an everyday part of life, it becomes just another part of life and not some horrible thing that where you feel like you're going to go to hell or you feel like you have to pick up a gun and shoot people over it. It's just so sad that there is so much pain in an area of life that really should be devoted to pleasure. It's just very distressing.
It is, and for people that truly know sexual pleasure, and I would include myself and my husband in that, and probably you and your wife of how many years? How long have you and Ann been married? A long time.
50 years.
Yeah, that's really impressive. Anyway, to know sexual pleasure is a wonderful thing, and especially as you age, and to be in your body, feel the release, and it really is the glue of a relationship, and it's just so good, and I think my clients appreciate that I'm a sexual cheerleader, and that we look at some of these taboos, and especially if they come out of a religious background. One of the great things about your book, Sizzling Sex for Life, is that you incorporate some. Isn't it about 2,500 studies in your
Yeah, 2,500
writing.
Studies. Yes, I always over-research, and for this book, I over-researched to the max.
Yeah, but it makes it so much more credible. And I like this study that you mention in this chapter we're discussing in your book, chapter 51, on men, porn, and the controversy surrounding sexual addiction. So you have, now I just went back to that. I want to quote the study just a second. Here we go. University of Oklahoma investigators asked parents, and this included 771 men and 904 women, how they felt about porn. Those most likely to revile it held the most fundamentalist religious views and reported the greatest anxiety, guilt, and shame about viewing. And there are so many studies that you quote in here, and maybe one more. In a survey, 2,279 adults, you write, the same researchers found that as church attendance and prayer frequently increased, so did the belief that porn is always wrong. But men expressing this view still watched a good deal, which triggered, well, we're back to this really sad loop, negative loop.
Right. Guilt and shame.
Men expressing this view still watched a good deal, which triggered severe anxiety. Let's talk a little bit about porn and why it doesn't have to be so, a little more about it, why it can be okay, and maybe even educational. And certainly, a man watching it and masturbating probably doesn't watch it, well, you quote this, it for too long, but just enough to have some release from his tension.
Right,
and
right.
So he'll watch a little bit of porn. Well, so let's talk about that.
Well, men who are in the spider web of so-called sex addiction often say, oh, I can't stop watching porn. Actually, what they're saying is that they enjoy masturbating. And so for a lot of them, the term masturbation is so toxic and has been so poisoned in their minds that they can hardly say the word. And they blame porn for making them masturbate, when in fact, masturbation is the purpose of porn. That's why porn exists, as a masturbation aid. You need to, great sex depends to some extent on sexual fantasies, and a lot of men, their fantasies get stale, and so porn provides a billion fantasies for free, a click away, and so men flock there. Porn is one of men's top destinations on the internet. The major porn sites have hundreds of billions of views a year, and you know, watching porn is normal, and it's not just normal for bad guys. I mean, there's the famous quote from Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart in 1964 in an obscenity case, said, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it.
indicating that he had seen it.
Yeah, not only had he seen it, but he sounded fairly familiar with it.
Right.
So, and this
exactly.
is a Supreme Court Justice of the United States. So, mm-hmm. you know, men watch a ton of porn, and as we're now learning, approximately one quarter of the porn audience is women. And a lot of women say, well, how could women watch this stuff? It shows male domination over women. Yeah, it does. Most porn is has some domination submission elements with the man in the dominant position. Not all, but usually the man is in the dominant position and the woman is in the subordinate position. And you know who the women are who watch porn? It turns out they're women who have significant sub fantasies. And this is, you know, they may or may not want to be actually sexually submissive in their real lives, but in their fantasy life, they are. They're submissive, and porn allows them to exercise that fantasy. When sex negative people attack porn, they are they're really aiming at the wrong target. They should be discussing solo sex, which is the single most popular form of lovemaking on earth.
Yeah,
and it has tremendous force. And, you know, in the ancient world, people masturbated, and masturbation was accepted throughout much of the ancient world because the ancients considered it, you know, inevitable. The only ethnic group that was really on record as opposing it was the Hebrews, who gave us, you know, Judaism and Christianity, and to some extent Islam as well. And so, unfortunately, we've been poisoned against masturbation by the Bible, and the Bible just is not that well informed about sexuality.
Indeed, not. I really, of course, you are just a fabulous writer, and one of the things that you write here is, porn is not evil. It's a cartoon version of men's fantasies of effortless sexual abundance. Virtually every internet-connected man on earth has seen porn. Well, you've already said that. Many frequently, some daily. It's okay to watch. That message has to get out there more, and it is good that some of the fundamentalist Christian churches are doing something about this, and you write that about a book written, co-authored by, who is this person, Reverend Beverly Dale, and it's called Advancing Sexual Health for the Christian Client. So it looks like this is a real step toward normalizing this and getting away some of the negativity around masturbation and porn and all of that.
Yes, there's a small but significant group of deeply devout Christians in the United States who are also sex positive and are trying to get away from the sex negativity of so much of the Christian church. And Reverend Beverly Dale, who is known as Rev Bev, is a leader in this group. And she came to her current position through, you know, a very painful childhood where she was, admonished constantly that sex is bad, sex is evil, don't let boys near you. And her parents told her nothing about sex or birth control. So guess what happened? She got pregnant as a teenager and had a long and unhappy journey through life until she came in contact with some religious folks who were sex positive, and that was what completely turned her around, and she decided to become a minister who would focus on a sex positive interpretation of Christianity and try to help other people who had been through the same horrible journey that had been imposed on her. So I have a lot of respect for Rev Bev, and of course she faces an enormous amount of headwinds in the evangelical community because it is in general so sex negative. And it's just sad. I mean, they're mistaken. Sex is basically for pleasure, and it's okay to have pleasure. It's perfectly okay to have pleasure. God created us to have pleasure.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Why would she do that if she didn't want us to have pleasure?
I like that. Yes. And also made our arms long enough to reach our genitals.
Right. Yes, that too.
Yeah, that too. and then we also have, I don't think you have it in this chapter, but elsewhere in your book, but the problems with disavowing and thinking that homosexuals are evil and will go to hell. So that eliminates a whole population of good people that just want to have a sex life with somebody they love who might be the same gender that they are.
Right, and, well... You know, God created everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And God loves all of his children, and that includes the gay people, the lesbians, the transsexuals, bisexual folks. I mean, everybody. I'm not a fundamentalist in my philosophy about life, and it's just so sad that people create these extremely false distinctions between good people and bad based on who they are, whether it's the sexuality they were born into, the race they were born into, the ethnicity they were born into, the religion they were born into. I mean, we're all the same. And and sex is about pleasure. And so the idea that it's about procreation is every now and then people do have sex to procreate, but that is one of the least frequent reasons that people have sex.
Yes, it is.
Like, as I said, the most popular form of sex on earth is self-sexing, and that's not procreative at all.
Yeah, that's right. It's not procreative at all. And you write in Chapter 51 sort of the history of... You mentioned Kinsey's 1948 studies, and we finally got the idea from his research that lots of people have recreational sex, and that women can enjoy it too. In 1948, this was bigger news.
Yeah, historically there are three reasons to have sex. One is procreation. The second is cementing of holy wedlock, and the third is recreational. And until Kinsey in the late 1940s, Everyone agreed that sex should be for procreation, and yeah, it could be for enhancing marriages as well, but that recreational sex was wrong. And, of course, there was always recreational sex in the United States. I mean, there's always sex workers, and there was always LGBT people. But until Kinsey came along and showed the enormous proportion of people who were not exclusively heterosexual and the number of people who admitted intercourse before marriage, it really turned the conventional wisdom on its head and showed that the idea that recreational sex was somehow wrong or harmful. Recreational sex was everywhere, and people embraced it enthusiastically. And since Kinsey, we've only learned more about this. That belief has been reinforced, that that sex is primarily about interpersonal attraction and pleasure. And yes, it may also have to do, people sometimes have sex to have children, and people may have sex to cement their relationships, but basically sex is about pleasure, and that's okay, that's fine. The deities, the higher powers, they want us to have pleasure. If not, if they didn't, God would have to be extremely perverse to make us enjoy pleasure and then tell us to deny it. Pleasure
good
is there
point,
to be
Michael.
Had and enjoyed. And I encourage all of your listeners to appreciate the pleasure potential of sex. And if you're from a fundamentalist background and you have issues, you have hesitation about enjoying the pleasure that your body can bring, I would urge you to consult a sex therapist who uses cognitive behavioral therapy and re-examine your beliefs. Because they are not doing you any good.
Yes, exactly. And you have a statistic that many people raised as religious or social conservatives feel deep distress about recreational organ grinding. I like that, organ grinding. They grew up hearing that they should save themselves until marriage, but only 5% of Americans do. You know, I remember in the 50s when I was a teenager, fortunately my parents were affectionate and demonstrative with each other and with us and gave us the whole facts of life information on a long car ride when I was like in fifth grade. But I do remember my mother distinctly saying, you know, in terms of having intercourse, wait till marriage. Give your husband a gift on your wedding night. That was 1956 or so that she said that, maybe a little bit later. So despite their openness, my parents' openness, there was still that, save yourself until marriage. And I decided not to. I gave back my, I had a very serious relationship in college, and it was a wonderful, fun relationship. In fact, he and I are still in touch just recently again. And but I realized I gave him back his fraternity pin, which then meant engaged to be engaged, because I was too young to get married. And I had a real sense of adventure, and I lived it out, and I'm so glad. So then I didn't marry the first time until I was 30, which gave me a chance to experiment and to find out what I liked and needed. And so often people that are very young really, well, even some older people, they don't know what they want and need and like.
Right.
Sexually speaking, because they haven't really experimented and allowed themselves a space for discovery and experimentation and maybe even masturbating in front of each other. For some of my couples,
yes.
I will suggest this. If I feel like they're at a place where they might do it. And, of course, some of them are a little bit shocked because it's such a private activity. But then they do it, and they report that it was fun and it was educational and illuminating to see how the partner would touch themselves. for pleasure.
Yes, well, intimacy is all about self-revelation. And usually, intimacy is about self-revelation with words, talking about your emotions and feelings. But what you just said is very intimate. What is more revealing of yourself than how you make love with yourself? And what is more instructional for a lover than to watch at close range how your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife brings themselves off sexually? I mean, that is about as intimate as human beings get with each other. And what you said about, you know, the proof of that recreational sex is everywhere is that very few Americans are virgins on their wedding nights.
Yeah,
very few.
5%, you said.
Right. Actually, yeah, at most 5% are virgins. And then a lot of those, that small group of virgins on their wedding night, they come out of their wedding night, the sex was bad. They were promised.
Yes.
They were promised if they saved themselves for marriage, the you know, it's going to be like the 4th of July with, you know, fireworks in the sky, and it's just going to be the most fantastic thing ever. And meanwhile, they don't know what they're doing. Sex is a skill that requires a fair amount of training. They have no training. It'd be like saying, save yourself for driving a car until you're 21, and then they throw you the keys, and they tell you, jump in the car and drive. Well, if you do that, you're going to crash the car. And that's what happens in so many of these marriages where people, quote-unquote, save themselves. They wind up saving themselves for more misery. And sex therapists often counsel people who have done this. I have a friend who's a sex therapist in Israel. And she says she has a steady parade of ultra-Orthodox Jews who come to her because their wedding night was a horrible failure. They just didn't know how to do it. They need to be trained in lovemaking. And that's something that most people sort of grope toward through their teen years and their young adulthood. They, you know, through trial and error, most people figure out how to be sexual and how to enjoy sexual satisfaction. But if you're one of the small minority of people who deny everything sexual and then expect, like magic, your wedding night is going to be wonderful, that is as mistaken an idea as any of the other ideas we've been talking about where the fundamentalists are totally wrong.
Absolutely. So in for the last part of the show, I would like to talk about solutions. And you have a very nice sexual healing page on 391 in your book. Sexual healing, the many benefits of solo and partner lovemaking. So we've been talking about the benefits, but you list them very well. Relaxation, pain relief, mood elevation, fitness, sleep, blood pressure control, bladder control, yes, hot flashes, immune enhancement, and prostate cancer prevention, and sperm quality, and conception, and longevity. And you complete this list by saying frequent sex, solo or partnered, offers many health benefits the sex addiction industry ignores.
Right. In the sex addiction industry, sex is almost always bad. I mean, if you're having children, okay, but you know, the sex addiction industry is a secularized spin on what used to be called perversion. If you were perverted, you were doing things sexually that the church did not allow. But perversion is kind of antiquated. And so the people behind the sex addiction philosophy invented this disease that really was just another way to say that people were having sex in ways that sexual conservatives didn't like. That's what it came down to. They just don't like it. You know, there's an old joke that asks, why was the Puritan so upset? Because
and why
somewhere
were they so upset?
Somebody was having fun.
Somebody was having fun.
Yeah, that upsets
and, you know, one of my favorite quotes that I think I made up, I might have read it years ago, but anyway, it's, if you're not having fun, you're simply not doing it right.
Right.
I'm all for pleasure and fun, and I think that so many of my clients appreciate that I am so sex positive. And, you know, you mentioned the Orthodox Jews. In the Seattle area where I live, we have a lot of Indians who were hired to come here to work for Microsoft or Amazon because, you know, they're software engineers and so on. And many of the couples I've seen since coming to Seattle have been Indian couples who had arranged marriages, and they had no sex education. Sometimes they don't see their wife or their husband until the day of the marriage. Yeah. So sometimes these arranged marriages can work out, but so often they have a lot of trouble. One of the Indian guys I was seeing didn't even know what the clitoris was or where it was, and I have my little hand vulva puppet. And so I brought that out back, this is pre-pandemic when I wasn't seeing everybody on Zoom. And so we talked about the clitoris and how important that the only function of the clitoris is for pleasure. It has no other function. And it has even more nerve endings, maybe 6,000 to 8,000, more than the penis has 4,000 about. And so sex education is really an important part of dealing with these people that want to have good sex, but they just don't know how.
Yeah, and, well, a lot of Asian cultures, yes, as you said, are very sex negative. And mm-hmm. Indian culture, it's ironic because this is the land of the Kama Sutra that was supposed to be.
I know. I presented at a conference
in
Mumbai in 2004, and the conference was swarmed with medical doctors from all over India, and they kept reminding us of the Kama Sutra. Of course, that was written in the 15th century, and you had to be really flexible. But the sex education just is really poor in India.
Well,
I think they're trying
Asia,
to make a difference now. But
yeah, in China, too. I mean, sex education is fairly poor all over the world.
And yes, it is.
And that's why, you know, sex therapists don't have to fear that they're ever going to be put out of business. And sex writers like me, I'll always have an audience because there's always new people coming of age, completely clueless about sex. And there are older people who, you know, their lives change, they get divorced, whatever, and they have sexual awakenings and they want to learn about it. And sex is a skill. People have to understand that lovemaking is a skill. It's like riding a bike, riding a car. You have to get some instruction. You have to have some practice. And you can do it responsibly or irresponsibly. And the more you know about lovemaking, the more confident you are and the more comfortable you are going to be with doing it responsibly and not having a situation like Reverend Beverly Dale had, where her parents said, no, 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 and then the next thing is she turns up pregnant. Is that what you want? The very people, the church fathers, who are counseling people to, you know, abstinence until marriage, they didn't abstain, and yet they expect everyone else to. It's so sad, and it's led to things like the shooting in Atlanta of a young fundamentalist guy, perpetrator, who hated himself, who hated sexuality, and also owned a gun, and that's what happened.
Yes, yes, yes. There was something in the paper about this guy whose last name is Long. His former roommate, and they were in a halfway house near Atlanta for sexual addiction, and so his roommate said that about once a month, Long would admit that he had again relapsed by visiting a massage parlor for sex. And He asked his roommate to take his computer away from him. He only used a flip phone, so he couldn't look on a smartphone at porn. I mean, all of these measures just made it worse for him with the guilt. And then he was compelled to shoot the women who he thought would create a temptation for him.
Yeah, well, so we're one of the rule of life is that if the therapy you're using only makes things worse, it's probably the wrong therapy.
Oh, that's so good. I'm going to quote you on that.
And so denying, so saying, oh, I'm going to stop watching porn and that's going to cure me of my sex problem. No, that doesn't work. That's the wrong therapy. What you need is to change your beliefs, to re-examine your beliefs, and hopefully with the help of a compassionate therapist, or a book like mine is a good place to start.
It's an excellent place to start.
But people who are far gone into what they label themselves as sex addicts, they probably need some face-to-face therapy.
And I want to just talk about you and remind people that they, and I'll put it in the show notes, that your website is greatsexguidance.com.
Yes, and I answer questions for free.
Yes. And what? I'm sorry, what was free?
On greatsexguidance.com, I answer people's sex questions for free.
Yes, you do. Yes, absolutely. And it's and you've answered more than 12,000 sex questions throughout your career. That's impressive.
Yep.
And then you have this All About Sex blog on Psychology Today, and you were answering questions for Playboy's advisor column in the 90s. And so you have lots of experience answering people's questions and good answers. And this book, people really need to get this book, and they can find it, perhaps the easiest way is on Amazon, Michael?
Yeah, well, there's two ways. Amazon has it, and also if people want to learn more about the book, they can go to the book's website, which is sizzlingsexforlife.com, and it can be ordered through there, too. But you also get you can see a little bit more about what's in the book on the book's own site.
Yeah, okay, and I'm going to put that in my show notes as well. I mean, when you were last on this program in November of 2020, I learned that the Library Journal calls you one of the nation's top health writers, because you write a lot about sex, but you also write about other health concerns. And I just feel like all of us have been so privileged to hear you. You're so sensible and clear. And people need to get this book. It's an encyclopedia of all kinds of sex and things that things you won't find anywhere else, but in your book. So,
well, thank you.
People need to get this book for sure. And I'm going to have you back on this program May 18th. So we'll pick another topic. There are so many in your book, but I'm really glad we had this conversation today about sexual addiction and in light and the evangelical fundamentalist contributions to perhaps to the shooter's mentality when he did the shooting on the 18th of March. So we'll find out more. Thank you, Michael, so much for
Thanks
being
for
here
having me
again.
On, Diana.
You are just a wonderful person. I've known you for many years. I like you so much, and you're just the best writer and answer questions. So I'll put all of this in my show notes about where they can get your book and sizzlingsexforlife.com, a little more about the book. Thank you, Michael. Is there one last thing you'd like to say?
I wish everyone sizzling sex for life.
Hey, yeah. I agree wholeheartedly. Sizzling sex for life. Oh, your life will be so much better if you have sizzling sex. Thank you again, Michael Castleman.
Thank
You're
you.
You're the best.
Bye.
You're welcome. Bye, everybody.
Happy feet. Happy feet. Da, da, da.